She pressed the cold can against it and then her oblique. Broken-jawed bitch really packed a wallop. But there she was that night, charging to freedom, not knowing where she was going, not caring about that in the least. After all those years. Then there'd been Joe Atkins, looming up in her field of vision like the big, bad boogeyman. Only she was bigger and badder than Joe would ever be. He was a gnat to be squashed. She lifted the beer can until it was upside down and she finished it off, wiped her chin, and pinched the joint out, saving the rest for later. She breathed in the reefer-scented smoke drifting in the air, like lines of miniature cumulus in her room, with the added benefit of making her high. Yes, there had been Joe. And then, he had been there no more. Squashed. Freedom. She lay back on the mattress, kicked her flip-flops off, and wriggled her long toes. She had cash, she had a single credit card that she used very sparingly, she had a place to live, wheels to go to other places. She had jobs that she did, crap that she pulled. Not all legal, but so what? Nothing done to her had been legal. Survival. She fell asleep thinking only of that. Just like pretty much every other night. It didn't make her feel worse, and it didn't make her feel better. But at least it made Kane feel something. Hallelujah. You survived it all, Elle. Now go to sleep and get ready for tomorrow. Just in case it comes. Chapter 10. Her phone alarm dinged at 6 a.m., and Kane rolled over and yawned. She sat up and opened the window to get out the final dregs of any lingering pot smoke. But she wasn't too worried. While they had random drug testing at her first place of work today, they used a blood test. A blood test could only detect THC, the component in pot that made you feel high, for about 3 hours after use. A saliva test could do it for between 24 and 72 hours. A urine test could nail you for up to 30 days after use. Hence, many employers used saliva, or more likely a blood test as their testing tool. Otherwise, they'd test their way right out of business, because they'd have no bodies to do the work. That was the dirty little secret of the crap work world, where millions labored every day, and the savviness of addicts who needed a job. She opened her fridge, cracked 3 eggs into a glass, and drank it down raw. She had seen this done in an old movie about a down-and-out boxer named Rocky. Protein, apparently, which helped your body recover and build. Which was good, Kane thought, because it tasted like shit and had the texture of snot. She changed into the outfit she had fought in, blood, sweat, and all, covered that with a hoodie and sweatpants, and slipped on a pair of worn sneakers. Then she left her place, padlocking the door on the other side. She ran for miles, her breath forming visible clouds with every exhale. Winter was coming with speed, but she would be snug in her little place, hopefully. She liked to run, and her long legs and frame were built for eating up massive quantities of ground. Kane had been running her whole life, sometimes for real, other times just in her mind, especially when she'd been locked up all those years. She would jog in place and let her imagination take her to any place other than the one she was in. The things she did in her mind to keep going, it was some wicked shit. Taught her stuff. Demonstrated that your mind could get you through anything. Anything. Because it had done so for her. Psalm of my life. If you can't live in the world you have, make one up. She stopped at 5 different tents and boxes and handed out cash from her prize money at each one. These were not boozers or druggies, at least not mostly. They would use the money for food and other necessaries because they all had young kids living with them in their distress.
Thank you,
said one young mom, who was white but looked brown with the sun and the dirt. Kane could relate. This was the tan of homelessness. It was unlike any other skin tanning ever, Kane knew. It fried your brain as well as your outside. It never really came off you, because you worried every minute it could happen again. It was like you were a fugitive for life, and your only crime was bad luck or bad choices. When the rich and powerful made a mistake, their lawyers and PR folks took care of it. Kane waved the woman's thanks off and kept running. The next family was black. The next one after that, too. The next one spoke Spanglish and shivered in the chill. The next family. She couldn't really tell what they were. Not that it mattered. They were breathing. They were human. They look like me in that way. That was enough. Boxes were meant to house stuff, not put people in. Not until they're dead, anyway. Most people looked at them and felt either sorry or disgusted, or both. Not Kane. She just saw folks who needed some help. At the end, she had given away over half her winnings. She knew what the term Good Samaritan meant, but only because of the Bible reading. But that was not why she was doing it. She did it because today she had money, and today they didn't, but needed it. Keep it simple, was Kane's motto. When you thought too hard about it, you tended to want to keep what you had and dare others to try to take it. She got back to her place and completed her daily workout with push-ups, floor dips, chin-ups on a bar wedged in a doorway, lots of ab and core work with a medicine ball, and exercises with a kettlebell she'd gotten for a buck from a gym going out of business. Then bodyweight lunges and squats and calisthenics, followed by shadow boxing. She finished with some heavy-duty stretching. The strong and vigilant don't always survive, but it damn sure improves your chances. She showered in cold water, because that was all there was. She had started her period late last night. She had had her first period at age 11, while she was with the Atkinses. She thought she was dying when the cramps came and the blood dripped from down there. She had begged Desiree to help her. The woman had laughed and thrown her a roll of paper towels, telling her that it would come every month like clockwork. She had added, "They sell stuff for it, but the paper towels will do for you. It's not like you're going anywhere, so deal with it." And Kane had dealt with it using the paper towels. Until Wanda Atkins had explained to Kane what was really going on and given her boxes of tampons. That had been an eye-opener. She remembered asking Wanda if boys had periods too. No, she had said. Good thing, because they couldn't handle it. Kane believed she spoke the literal truth. Wanda had been nice to her, sneaking her books, taking care of some medical needs, bringing her some extra food. But she never once made any effort to free her. There were limits, Kane supposed, to people's generosity and morals. Chapter 11. For 25 hours a week and $9 an hour, Kane operated a forklift loading packing crates onto tractor trailers. They wouldn't allow her full-time work, because that came with benefits and other rights. All the guys there, she was the only female, were also part-timers. She parked her Honda outside the terminal, put on her hard hat and protective shoe coverings and safety goggles, punched the clock, and climbed into her little rig. They could have gotten plenty of guys with heavy equipment operating licenses to do this, and who had been laid off in the recent downturn. But Kane was a lot cheaper, and didn't demand full-time work. People like her were a hot commodity in the free market right now. She was a worker who didn't mind getting screwed. Employers loved her. She liked the work because she didn't really have to talk to or deal with anyone. She just climbed into her seat, manipulated her ride hauling the crates and boxes, and did her thing. Years before, she had earned a good living doing similar work. Then she'd been injured on the job, and the painkillers had helped a lot, so she kept taking them. Then came the day when she couldn't stop taking them. And then it wasn't just painkillers. It was anything she could snort, swallow, or stick herself with. And there went her job and everything else. Someone had suggested counseling. She had gone to one person, but when he'd asked about any troubles in her past, she got up and left. It wasn't worth it. Kane knew if she waded back into that, she'd just slit her wrists. There was only one way for her to go, and that was forward. Some psych guy could write a book on her, but Kane would never read it. She had lived it. One ride through hell was enough. Kane had never been to prison, only in jails for short periods for stupid crap she shouldn't have done. Petty thefts, DUIs, drug possession, throwing a drunk accountant through a plate glass window for grabbing first her ass and then her breasts, only to have his buddies swear it was all her. Stuff like that. Shit happened. Shit just happened to her more than to a lot of others, it seemed. Each time she was arrested, she'd been afraid that her ID and manufactured past would not pass muster and uncomfortable questions would follow. Yet she had found that the police in real life were not quite the stuff you saw on TV. The computers were old and boxy, the offices drab, the clothes they wore drabber still. There wasn't an ounce of sexy among the whole crew. The morale was low, and the energy to go above and beyond on low-end cases like hers was virtually non-existent. She was one piece of dull paper in a billion. Just shuffle her through, because who really gave a crap? Thank God for that. She clocked out on the dot. She was about to get into her car when a new guy came up to her. His job was to fuel and detail the trucks, or at least she had seen him doing that. He was lean, too thin, really, with a scraggly, ill-groomed beard, twitchy eyes, and a conceited expression, at least to Kane.
"Hey,"
he said. "Yeah?"
"Hey, you don't like guys."
"What makes you say that?" He grinned.
"'Cause you've never gone out with none of the boys here."
"You talking about the one guy who has teeth or all the others?"
"Hey, that's bitchy,"
he said, frowning. "What the hell do you care?"
"I don't know. Look, forget it. Shit, I mean, what the hell is your problem?"
Kane said, "I got no problem. Just here doing my job, and now I'm going to do another job." His expression changed from angry to curious.
"Yeah? Where is that?"
"Why?"
"I make chump change here. I clean offices at night, but that pays shit too, and it ain't regular work. Look."
He glanced around nervously and then lit up a cigarette. His hands were shaky.
"Look, I got me a kid, and my old lady ain't doing too good. Rehab, you know, meth. It's a bitch."
She looked him over and decided his old lady wasn't the only one fighting a meth addiction. Kane saw all the signs, because she'd been there too. Detailing trucks and cleaning offices, not much future. Same goes for meth. You don't kick that, nothing else matters because it gets in your head and you can't do anything else but worry about the next pop and how to get it.
"Shit, I know that. So what else do you do?"
he asked. She looked him over. "I do group lift rides 3 times a week in the afternoon. My car's not pretty, but it takes people who don't have a lot of dollars where they need to go. Not great money, but it's something. Then I go home and sleep. Then 4 nights a week, I work security making rounds at a gated community a few miles outside of downtown. 10 to 6 in the morning. I'm on duty tonight, in fact. They used to have their own private police force, but then they outsourced it to save money. See, even the rich pinch pennies sometimes. It pays $8.50 an hour. No real bennies, but there's no heavy lifting, and you get a little car to drive around in. I've been doing it for 6 months, and the only thing that happened was I had to roust some pothead kids out of a rich dude's pool."
"Security job? I can't pass no background check, and if I have to pee into—"
she interrupted. "They don't do any of that. No pee cups. No tests. At least they never have with me. They're supposed to, I guess, but the place that hired me, I went in for an interview at 4 in the afternoon and was on duty at 10 that night. The only thing they asked me was what size uniform I took and whether I wanted a gun. They just want bodies riding around in a uniform looking like they know what they're doing. Optics, they call it."
"No training? Really?"
"If they had to get people to pee or pass a background check, they might as well close up shop. No Ivy Leaguers are applying for this stuff." He took a puff on the cigarette and slowly blew the smoke out while he stared at the ground.
"I guess that's right."
"And anyway, All the homes have these fancy security systems and surveillance cameras out the ass. We're just gravy on top of the mashed potatoes.
And did you want a gun?
No.
Why not?
For $8.50 an hour? I got a gun, they got a gun. They're more likely to shoot me.
I think I'd go for a gun.
She looked him over. You know how to use one?
Sure. How do I apply for a job?
She pulled out a piece of paper and pen from her glove box, spun him around, and used his back as a desk as she wrote a phone number down. She handed it to him. Here, tell him L. Kane sent you. It might help. I know the extra cash comes in handy. After they take out taxes and crap, it's around $220 a week.
Shit, that's more than I make here. They pay me under the table, so it's less than minimum. But they feed me lunch, and there's usually some leftover donuts for breakfast.
There you go. You can buy your own donuts. He looked at the paper and said,
Thanks. I mean it, really.
No problem. Hope it works out. He looked at her bruised face, apparently focusing on it for the first time.
Damn, what happened there?
Got in a fight.
Who with?
Some other chick. She ended up in the hospital to get her jaw wired and to hopefully think about something else to do with her life. I ended up going home and having a beer. He chuckled as though he thought she was kidding.
But do you like guys?
I like some guys some of the time. I don't like most guys most of the time. He grinned and stuffed the paper into his shirt pocket.
You're not like what they said.
I'm not like what anybody says, because nobody really knows me. And that's how I want it. Chapter 12. You, a rental cop. Now that's a good one. In the rearview mirror, Kane was staring at herself in a plain gray uniform with chevrons on the sleeve, signifying absolutely nothing. It was just more optics. She was perched in her tiny two-door smart car with the name Steel Security Services airbrushed on the side panels in nifty colors. There was an orange bubble light on top of the car that she would turn on from time to time, and then she'd speed around just to break up the boredom. She had the seat all the way back, but with her long legs, she still felt cramped. She had been on duty for about 2 hours. It was a bit after midnight. She had made several rounds over her area of responsibility and found zero cause for concern. Certainly the rich were sensibly afraid that someone would try to take what they had, but the truth was, most thieves went for easier targets, like the poor and working class, and sometimes reaching up to grab onto those in the middle of the economic pecking order. There was a gatehouse on the only road into the community, and it was manned by an armed guard 24/7. There were also two cars patrolling the neighborhood during the night, one of which was hers. The homes had all the latest gizmos and security, with more cameras than a Hollywood backlot. All in all, this was one tough nut for someone to crack. You made a 911 call from here, the real and rental cops would show up before you put down the phone. Someone had broken into an apartment she'd had once in Detroit, in an area that could have been generously called in transition. She called 911, but the cops hadn't even bothered to come. They were probably scared to. She started on another round through the subdivision, and even though she'd seen them many times before, Kane found herself still marveling at the size of the homes, or estates, that were located here. They looked like mini hotels. They all had landscaped grounds, lavish in-ground pools, guest houses, and elaborate statuary, with each owner clearly trying to outdo his neighbor, if the amount of remodeling and new construction work being done was any indication. But hey, you had to do something with the cash. She had no idea what the homeowners did to earn enough to live in places like this, but she knew she would never be among their number. And she was okay with that. She didn't want to live in a place so big that she might get lost. Later, she pulled off the road, had a cup of lukewarm coffee poured from her thermos, and pecked in notes on the iPad the security firm gave her to use. The observations were perfunctory, and were really only meant to show that she was actually doing something. She seriously doubted anyone read them. And if they did, it was a massive waste of time. Nearly hit squirrel, heard dog bark, saw rich white girl sneak out and jump into clunker hatchback with poor brown boy and they drove off. Saw drunk homeowner pawing equally drunk woman half his age and not his wife as they stumbled into house, getting naked along the way. Same old crap. Kane turned on the radio, drank her coffee, and scrolled through her phone. Amazing things, these phones. When she'd first learned of the internet, it had blown her away. That was some seriously cool shit. There was so much she didn't know that she had had to prioritize and focus on the things she needed in order to get by. That was it. All the rest, she just winged it. Kane wanted to smoke some weed for the chronic pain she suffered from, but that would get her fired if her employer somehow found out. And she couldn't afford to blow such a cushy job. She doubted after her last fight, and bust up with Sam, that she would be getting any cage matches for a while. Besides her rotator issue, one doctor had told her she had an irregular heartbeat. She should be on meds for it, but meds were for people with insurance. She also needed some dental work done, and she had to take care of a few other medical issues too. But without health coverage, you just had to deal with it until you had the cash. She had already spent pretty much all her savings on having an old back injury remedied. She'd refused to put it on her plastic. Not that her credit limit would have been enough. She'd asked the surgeon if she really needed to do it. He had told her, "Not if you don't care about being in a wheelchair in 5 years." When she got really sick, she went to the emergency room. They did what they did, then billed her a shitload of money that she couldn't and didn't pay. It is what it is, I guess. The Atkinses had not believed in doctor and dentist visits, at least for her. The first time Kane had seen either was when she had been on her own for 2 years. 3 rotted teeth had come out of her mouth, and 2 implants had gone in, and a month later, she'd had surgeries for a hernia, a torn muscle, and a broken arm that dated back to when she was 10 and had never gotten proper medical attention. The dentist, GP, and surgeon, respectively, had quizzed her as to why her parents had not addressed these issues before then. She had lied and told them her parents were dead, and she'd been raised by her grandmother, who was not quite right in the head. They had all let that pass, which was good, since she didn't have a backup lie at the time. She'd since gotten much better with her web of fabrications. The dentist, GP, surgeon, and hospital had then sued her for the unpaid bills because her checks bounced like basketballs. She had skipped town, which was the only thing she could think to do at the time. She looked down at her left foot and quickly wriggled it as the pain shot through. The copperhead had bitten her there when she was 13, while she'd been picking up wood from a stack to carry into the house. Her damn foot had swelled up. The venom started eating her skin away, and a serious infection had set in. Desiree had poured what she called magic water over it and spoke some gibberish Kane couldn't understand, and she doubted Desiree could either. 3 weeks later, Kane had come out of a coma, a term she had learned about later. Wanda had been there when she came to. Wanda apparently had some medical training. Kane's foot had been heavily bandaged, and there were some bottles of medicine next to her bed. The dressings smelled strongly of what she now knew was antiseptic. The skin on her foot would never look the same. But she didn't care. Kane had lived. What more could she hope for? These musings abruptly stopped when Kane heard the announcer on the radio. Rebecca Atkins. The FBI was looking for a Rebecca Atkins from Georgia in connection with a matter from the early 2000s. Anyone with information about her was to call the number provided by the FBI, and there was also an email address provided. When she had been held captive all those years, a cold dread would come over Kane whenever she heard the footsteps coming closer. This was when she was younger and unable to defend herself. What would happen when the door opened? What was Desiree's mood? Cruel? Batshit? Drunk and docile? Or doped up and mean? Was Joe going to be regular Joe? Or Monster Joe? How bad would it hurt? Would she cry? It was a feeling like your stomach had turned in on itself, that your blood had solidified, and where your hearing became so acute, you could hear grass bending into the wind at 100 yards. Your entire world was condensed to the shape of a door with your heart pounding at the thought of what would come through it. The monster of every fairy tale nightmare. Only this monster lived in the house with her. She hadn't felt the freezies, as she had called them, since she had turned 15. When she had grown to her full height and was as strong as a horse, the comings of the Atkinses no longer terrified her. After that, she had terrified them. But she still had been a prisoner. Now the debilitating freezies were settling in all over her body. The FBI was looking for her about an incident in Georgia from the early 2000s. There could only be one incident involving Rebecca Atkins from Georgia during that time. She took out her joint and lit up, sucking the smoke into her lungs like these were the last pops of weed she would ever take. The PSA ended, and the radio channel went on to something else. But for Kane, there was no going on to something else. Headlights suddenly slammed against her windshield like a wave of water. When she saw it was her colleague in the other steel security clown car, she lowered the joint out of sight, but did not roll down the window, though he opened his. She held her phone up to her ear as though she were on a call. He smiled, nodded in understanding, and drove on. For the next 6 hours, Kane drove around and around like she was on some giant carousel that didn't have an off button. But she wasn't seeing any of the houses, or random car or person, even though they were all there. All she could think was, the FBI was looking for her in connection with an incident. Her shift ended, and she aired out the car before dropping it off and getting back into her ride in the steel security parking lot. She had a sudden thought and used her phone to go online and Google FBI and Rebecca Atkins. This took her to the FBI's official website and caused her another shock as a fuzzy still photo came up on the screen. It was her, after she had just burst through that door on her way to freedom.
I look batshit. And I probably was.
No, I definitely was. But I was also cunning. I was focused in my total madness. I just wanted out. Who wouldn't have? She looked in the mirror again, and then stared at the image on her phone screen. She breathed a sigh of relief. There was no way anyone would think those were the same person. Her hair was long. Her face was thinner and drawn and filthy. She looked like a lifetime member of some insane asylum. While she didn't necessarily look normal now, she didn't look like that anymore either. Kane sat back and thought about those first few months of freedom. She had hitchhiked across the country, putting as much space between her and Georgia as she could, finally stopping at the Pacific Ocean, which she didn't even know was called that. She didn't even know how many states there were. She didn't know what California was. It had taken her years to build up even a semblance of basic knowledge. I had to teach myself to drive a car, take medicine, and read something other than picture books, though the librarians over the years had helped me a lot with that. I had to learn how to write my name in something other than block letters, to add and subtract. Hell, what was a credit card? Or a rent payment? Or an email? Or a smartphone? Or a computer and the internet? Or a million other things that everyone else took for granted, but I never could. She leaned her head into the steering wheel. You've overcome so much, Elle. Think about that. She drove home to get ready to go to work. She would sleep later, after her forklift gig. She would bag working out and being a cheap chauffeur today. She didn't like people looking for her. She didn't want to be found. Only bad things could happen from that. And haven't enough bad things already happened to me? Well, apparently not.
Chapter 13.
Son of a bitch.
Kane had returned to her home to find that the padlock she used had been removed and another put in its place, and her clothes, books, and other possessions had been tossed on the ground right outside her residential pod. That included her beer and what little food she had up there, and that was now rotted and also torn up by animals. Tacked on the wall next to the lock was an official-looking notice proclaiming that any trespassers would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Still in there, under the floorboard, was all her cash, her stash of pot, and her Glock.
Assholes,
the voice said. She turned to see the elderly man walking up to her. He was too thin, too shaky, and he looked ready to drop dead at her feet. He was also her neighbor and a good, kind person. What in the hell happened, Saul? She asked.
They came last night, Al. Tossed all my stuff out along with me. Ruined my only good pair of pants and all my bottles of Ensura for shit. And that costs a pretty penny. Assholes.
He spat on the ground. Who are they?
Said they were hired by the folks that just bought this place. Some people on the West Coast, they said. Planned to turn it into luxury condos or some such.
But my rent's paid through the end of the month.
So's mine. I told them fellas that. They told me it wasn't their problem. I could go to court and sue.
Right, like we can afford to hire lawyers. But I still got stuff in there.
I don't know what to tell you, Al. They threw my ass out last night around midnight. Scared the shit out of me. Just cut my lock clean in two. They'd done it to everybody here. Had the cops with them, just in case.
Cops? But how can they evict people if they've paid their rent? I thought there were laws.
Hell, laws are for the rich folks. You think anybody gives a shit about us? And when I tried to argue the point, one of them said the rent money we supposedly paid wasn't, that we were illegally squatting.
That's bullshit. What else did these guys tell you?
Told me if I come back, they'd toss me in the can.
But you are back.
Hell, I never went away. I slept next to the dumpster.
Where are these guys now?
I think they're coming back tonight. They said something about fencing in the whole kit and caboodle then.
What are you gonna do now?
This was the only place I could afford. Just got my Social Security and whatever I can earn. Guess I'll check out one of the homeless shelters. But last time I did, they was full up. And they got some mean suckers in there. Do stuff to you. Take your things, what little you got. I'll probably go to the underpass, or maybe down by the river. They got a little shanty town there, at least till I find something else. Well, good luck.
He tottered off to move on with his life. She had to admire his pluck in the face of losing basically everything he had. Kane picked up all her things and carried them to her car. She returned to the building and looked at the padlocked door. She was calculating how best to do this.
Hey!
She turned to see the man striding toward her. He was in his 30s, about her height, around 200 muscular pounds. His blunt expression was as serious as a man about to go to war. He had a holstered pistol and wore the uniform of a private security service. Hey, right back, said Kane. He stopped cold when he saw her uniform.
Who are you?
Who the hell are you?
Dwight Talbot. I'm on duty here to secure this place.
Well, so am I. Name's Donna White. I just got called up to come here, and that's after pulling a graveyard shift. He looked at the logo and name on her uniform.
Steel Security? I used to work for them. They lowball the guards.
Tell me about it. When did you make the switch to Douglas? She said, noting the name and logo embroidered on his sleeve.
About 6 months ago.
Smart man. I might do the same.
I didn't know Steele was on this job, too.
I just go where I'm told. You know how it is.
Yeah, I damn well do.
West Coaster's putting up luxury condos here, so I heard, she said smoothly.
Hell, I was wondering what they were doing with this pile of crap. When I was a kid, they made furniture here. At least I think.
Well, we'll never be able to afford to live here. I don't have luxury in my future.
Me too, That's the damn truth.
Look, said Kane. I know they cleared everybody out last night, but have they checked out all these buildings?
Dunno. Why?
Because when I got here, I could have sworn I heard somebody inside this one.
Shit, really?
Yeah, but the door's padlocked. You want to call the cops? Although, if I'm wrong, we might get our asses handed to us. But if I'm right, and we score the prick ourselves...
We might cop a bonus,
said Talbot. What I'm thinking.
How do you want to do this?
You got a key for the lock. I was supposed to get a copy, but in all the rush, they never got it to me. Talbot pulled out a key on a large ring from his pocket.
This is a master. Fits all the ones they put on last night.
Cool. Okay, hand it over. I'll pop the lock and let's go in. You got the gun, so you cover my back, okay?
Okay.
He passed her the key and took out his pistol. Just don't shoot me by accident, Dwight. He grinned.
Hell, Donna, that ain't gonna happen, hon.
Just checking. She unlocked the door, and they quietly made their way inside and up a short flight of steps. The interior was tiny, with only two doors. Kane knew one led to her bedroom and the other to the bathroom. You check that door, she said, pointing to the bathroom door. I'll do the other.
You sure you want to split up?
Said Dwight.
You don't have a gun.
She slid out her baton. I got this, and I do MMA.
For shit, really?
Yeah, just won a match the other night.
Well, you look like you can take care of yourself, that's for sure. Just holler if you need me, hon.
He went left, and Kane entered her room on the right. She eyed the floorboard and thought quickly. She opened the window and then stepped back. Hey, Dwight, come quick, she called out. Talbot bolted into the room.
There was nobody in the bathroom,
he said.
What's up?
Kane pointed at the window. Just saw the asshole running into the woods behind here. He must have gotten in and then out through this window when he heard us coming. You look faster than me. Go after him and I'll call this in.
Right, I'll get the son of a bitch.
Talbot bolted outside. As soon as Kane heard the door bang open, she lifted up the floorboard, took out her cash, gun, and pot, put the board back, and ran down the stairs and out the door. She put all her stuff in her car and was back at the building when Talbot came huffing back.
He must have got away,
said Talbot, bending over and sucking in air.
You call it in?
Been trying. Damn cell phone's got no bars. You're gonna have to do it.
Oh, okay.
He straightened and made the call. When he was done, Kane looked down at her phone. Hell, now I get a call coming in? I hate AT&T. She put it to her ear. Yeah? What? Yeah, this is Donna White. You're shitting me, right? No, really, you're shitting me. Okay, well, screw you, too. She put the phone away in her pocket with a disgusted look on her face.
What was that all about?
Dwight asked anxiously. Steele just canned my ass. And you want to know why? Because they saw on the film from last night that I dozed off for like 10 seconds. Like no rental cop's ever done that.
Sorry asses,
exclaimed Talbot. So they just told me to get my butt back and turn in all my stuff. Yeah, I'll turn it in. I'll throw it in a fucking dumpster.
What I would do, no lie, hon,
said Talbot. Well, hang in there, Dwight. Don't let them screw with you.
Okay, Donna. Hey, sorry, gal.
Yeah, everybody's got problems, but I'm still breathing, right? And look, don't even mention I was here to anybody, okay? They'll probably try to pull some bullshit about something that happened so they can screw me out of my last paycheck.
Hey, my lips are zipped.
She fist bumped him, went to her car, climbed in, and drove off. Oh, Dwight, what a dumbass you are. And thank you for that, hun. She settled her gaze on the road. Now she just had to find a new place to live. And she still had the little matter of the FBI looking for her. She needed to do something about that. Only what? Chapter 14. Atlee Pine and Carol Blum pulled into Huntsville, Alabama. Located in the Tennessee River Valley, it was a stately, historic southern town with a growing population and a modern veneer over the aged antebellum underbelly. It had rich parts, poor parts, and in-between parts, just like every other town. Its economy had moved from cotton mills to textile plants to the space program, and now centered on biotechnology. It was an interesting mix of old and new. Storied families with long lineages, and old, sprawling homes with pillars out front and water views out back, facing a wave of diverse newcomers coming for good-paying jobs, interesting work, and cheaper housing than could be found in the Northeast, California, Florida, or Texas. After skirting the downtown area and driving for a while, they pulled into the gravel drive of a one-story brick and siding rancher. It covered about 1,200 square feet in a neighborhood of 70s-era homes that had probably cycled through several generations of families, and would probably cycle through several more before all was said and done. Pine knocked on a door that had peeling paint and a tarnished and dented brass footplate. A few moments later, they heard a woman's raspy voice through the closed door.
"Yes?"
"Mrs. Atkins?"
"Yes?"
The voice was now both worried and intrigued. "I'm with the FBI. I'd like to talk to you."
"The FBI? Is this some sort of joke?"
"No, it's not." Pine took out her shield and placed it against the dirty side light next to the door. She could see a woman's blurred, wrinkled face studying the FBI badge through the glass.
"Okay, what is this about?"
"Your son, Joe Atkins."
"Joe? He's long since dead."
"I know. That's what we want to talk to you about. Please, it's important." They could hear the lock being turned back and the door slowly opened. Wanda Atkins was nearly 80 now, shriveled and withered by the years into something both hard and soft. She had on khaki pants and a white blouse and wore thick white orthopedic shoes that looked as though they weighed about 2 pounds each. She was also using a metal cane with a curved handle and a wide bottom for support. Her hair had been permed beyond all reasonable recovery, with tufts missing and revealing pink scalp underneath. Her face was a mass of embedded concentric lines, and her eyes were set deep in the shrunken hollows of the sockets. Still, they were youngish eyes paired with the tanned skin and bedlam of wrinkles. The effect was a bit unnerving, like Pine was watching the woman age right in front of her. She had a cannula in her nose, and a long oxygen line connected to it went down to the floor and then out of sight into the house.
"Now what is this about Joe?"
"May we come in?" asked Pine. Atkins glanced at Blum, who said, "We're just here for information, Mrs. Atkins." Perhaps comforted by Blum's age and innocuous appearance, Atkins stepped back so they could move into the house. They were immediately hit by mingled odors of bleach, mustiness, and fried foods.
"You'll have to excuse me. I have to give Lynn his medication," said Atkins, moving past them. "He needs them right on time."
They followed her into the next room. The house was cluttered with cardboard boxes stacked up and piles of unread, folded newspapers and magazines, and what looked to be insurance and medical papers. Dust had accumulated on every surface that Pine could see. Two large oxygen tanks sat in holders against one wall, along with a portable oxygen concentrator that was connected to the line attached to Atkins's cannula. There were also boxes of tubing and what looked to be a CPAP machine on a table. Two aluminum walkers were perched against a wall. A blood pressure monitor hung on a stand, and a gurney with collapsible sides was set against another wall. Prescription bottles lined one table and sat next to an elongated pill dispenser organized by days of the week. The dispenser's bins were chock full of pills. It looked like an ICU room in the suburbs. Strapped into a wheelchair was, Pine assumed, Len Atkins. His bald head and withered body listed to one side, his tongue was hanging out, and he was drooling onto a bib tied around his neck. He looked like the roughened shell of a human being nearing its expiration date. Atkins poured some liquid from a brown bottle into a small measuring cup eyeing the dosage carefully, and then poured that into a glass of water. She then placed a straw in the glass.
Lynn, it's time, sweetie. You need to drink this.
Len perked up a bit, his gaze running around the room until it found his wife standing right in front of him. She put the straw in his mouth, and he started to suck on it. It took about a minute, but he got the liquid down. She wiped his mouth and put the glass down. She turned to them and said in a very low voice,
"He had a stroke last year. The doctors say this is as good as he's going to be. He can't walk or talk or do much of anything else, really. I think he can understand most things. We have an aide that comes in 4 times a week, but on days she's not here, it's tough. Most times I get the lady next door to help. She's in her 30s and very strong. And I'm not without disabilities either."
She glanced at the oxygen tank.
"I have pretty bad COPD. Please, God, never pick up a cigarette. It's not pretty. And I'm ashamed to say I still can't kick the nicotine habit. But what the hell does it matter now?"
Pine said, "Well, with all this oxygen around, it might matter a lot if some of it leaks."
"That's why I vape. No need for matches. We can leave Lynn here if you want and talk in the kitchen about Joe."
"You said he can understand things?" said Pine.
"Yes."
"Then if you don't mind, I'd prefer that he listen in." Atkins stiffened at this remark, but raised no objection. Chapter 15. Pine shifted stacks of papers and mail out of the way to make room for her and Blum to sit. Atkins perched on a piano bench in front of an old, scarred upright, its row of white keys yellowed by time, too much sunlight, and lack of care.
"Now what's this about Joe?"
"We've been to your old trailer in Georgia," began Pine. "It's full of snakes." She scowled.
"I'm not surprised. We didn't even bother to sell it. We just left. Nobody would have wanted that thing. Over the years, we got all new furniture."
"And you moved here about, what, 18 or so years ago?"
"Something like that. Look, what is this about?" she added sharply.
"It's about this." Pine took something out of her pocket. It was the photo of Len and Wanda Atkins and Mercy that Pine had found in the attic of Ito Vincenzo's beach house in New Jersey. She held it up for Atkins to see. The woman blinked rapidly and then let out a little gasp, her shaky hand going to her quivering lips. "That's you and your husband, and this is a woman that you called Rebecca Atkins, but her real name is Mercy. She was kidnapped by a man named Ito Vincenzo from her home in Andersonville, Georgia, and brought to live with you. We know that Ito and your husband served in Vietnam together, and Len saved Ito's life. So that's why he brought her to you, I suppose. I'm not sure, but he might have been under the mistaken impression that your husband could never father a child because of the wounds he suffered, not knowing that you already had a son. But at that point in your life, I suppose you didn't want to care for a 6-year-old, so you turned her over to Joe and Desiree." Atkins's eyes filled with tears, and she put a hand over her mouth and started to cough uncontrollably. Blum rose and hurried into the kitchen, and Pine could hear water running. Then Blum came out with a full glass of water and handed it to Atkins. The woman drank it down and composed herself, taking long breaths, greedily sucking on the supplemental oxygen provided by the cannula. Pine put the photo away and looked expectantly at the woman. Now that she was facing a key person in her sister's life after the abduction, she was not leaving without making significant progress in her search. Atkins pulled out a Kleenex from her pants pocket and rubbed her eyes and nose, shifting the cannula to the side to do so.
"Didn't realize how chunky I was back then," she said. "I've lost quite a bit of weight since that picture was taken. But Lynn is just as bald as ever."
When she saw Pine staring stonily at her, she hurried on.
"You're right. Lynn knew Ito and did save his life. But we had Joe before Lynn went to Vietnam,
and Ito and Lynn kept in touch over the years. He knew about our having Joe.
Then maybe he came to you because you were the only ones he knew who lived close to Andersonville. But I'm more interested in what took place when Ito brought Mercy to you.
He showed up in the middle of the night, pounding on the door, waking us up. Scared the hell out of me. I remember it so clearly. Ito was really shaken up, nervous as hell, almost out of his mind with panic.
Where did he say he got Mercy?
He said Becky, or Mercy, had been abandoned, that she didn't have anybody.
And did he say how he came to have her?
He said he found her on the side of the road, just walking along.
And she didn't tell you otherwise. She was six. She could talk. She knew things. She didn't tell you that her name was Mercy and that Ito had taken her away from her family?
Not that I recall, no, said Atkins, not meeting her eye. She was very quiet. Didn't say nothing. I tried to get her to eat or drink something, but she wouldn't. She seemed terrified.
Pine sat back. And later, you didn't see all the news coverage and flyers and everything with Mercy's picture on them? You lived barely 2 hours from where she was taken. The state of Georgia was saturated with news about her abduction. Atkins glanced anxiously at her husband.
I don't. It was such a long time ago and all, and there wasn't anything about it when Ito showed up with her.
Because no one knew she had been abducted at that point. But now comes the big question. Why didn't Ito, or you, take Mercy to the police? When you find an abandoned child, that's what you do, right? Atkins looked extremely nervous now.
I asked Ito that. I said, well, we need to call in the authorities. They'll know what to do.
And how did he respond to that? Asked Blum. Atkins twisted her hands in her lap and sucked heavily on her oxygen.
At first, he said that he had been in foster care growing up and that it would be a nightmare. He said the authorities would do that to her, and she might be abused, and heaven knew what else.
But that didn't have to be the only option. They could try to find her parents and see why they had abandoned her, as he claimed, countered Pine.
I said that very thing to Ito, and that they might find other relatives who could take her in.
And his response? Blum added.
And you said it first. Does that mean his story changed? Yes, it did. That's when things started getting really weird. Ito next told us that she really hadn't been abandoned. He moved us away from the girl so she couldn't hear, and said that the parents had been trying to kill Mercy when he happened by. He rescued her from them and they ran off. He said they were probably clear out of the state by now.
They were trying to kill their own daughter and Ito just happened to be passing by, Pine said, her tone full of derision. And why would he care if she heard that or not? If it had really happened, she would have known her parents were trying to kill her.
I know how it sounds now, said Atkins in a defensive tone. But we had just been woken out of a deep sleep and had a child dropped on us. We weren't thinking too clearly.
I'm sure no one would have been, said Blum in a soothing tone.
Thank you for saying that, said Atkins with a grateful look.
She wiped her nose with the Kleenex.
It was all a nightmare.
So you believed what Ito said? Asked Pine.
He was very convincing. And why would he lie? Why would he show up at our place with a child like that?
He lived in Trenton, New Jersey. Did he say why he was in Georgia running around in the middle of the night?
He said he was coming to visit us as a surprise.
Andersonville is south of where you lived, said Pine. He would never have reached that town if he were simply coming to visit you.
But we didn't know that, because he never said anything about Andersonville. He never told us where he'd found her.
Okay, so you took Mercy?
Yes. We didn't know what else to do. Lynn wasn't thrilled about it, but I couldn't see any other way. And what happened to Ito? Did he leave that night?
Yes. He said he was going back to where he'd gotten Mercy to see what was going on.
Yes, that's exactly what he did, said Pine. She knew that the next morning, Ito Vincenzo had gotten into a fight with Tim Pine outside their house. He had accused Tim of kidnapping and killing his own daughter, even though he knew that was not true.
And did you ever see him after that? Asked Pine.
No, he never came back. But he wrote letters, and he sent some money every year. I would use it to get Becky things.
Yeah, I know about the payments he made. That was how we found out about you in the first place. So you never contacted him about Mercy? Never asked him to come and get her, or whether he had found out anything else about her?
Well, he never called us about anything, and we didn't think trying to pressure him would do any good.
Pine shook her head, looking incredulous. Okay, let's get back to the photo I showed you and fast forward in time. Are you saying you couldn't tell from the state of Mercy that day that something was wrong? She was filthy and had wounds and bruises and marks on her skin. Atkins's eyes once more filled with tears.
Look, I don't want to get into trouble.
Blum said, All we want is the truth, Mrs. Atkins. Pine added, We know more or less what happened the night your son died. What we don't know is exactly how he died, or what happened to Desiree and Mercy.
Why would you think we would know about that?
They heard a grunt and turned to see Len Atkins holding up a stiff arm and pointing at his wife. He grunted again. He apparently had been listening to the entire conversation and was not happy with the direction it had taken. Atkins seemed to be able to decipher this. She put her hands in her lap and said in a resigned tone,
It was Desiree. You have to understand that. Joe had his issues, but Desiree, that woman was the devil. Not at first, not when they got married, but later. That's when her true colors came out.
We've talked to the former sheriff where you used to live, Dick Roberts. He told us about Desiree. He called her the voodoo lady. He said he was called out one night because Desiree was torturing a dog.
Dick was a good man, and he was right about Desiree. She was pure evil.
Did you know they were holding Mercy in a prison out behind their house? Atkins's top lip trembled.
Am I going to go to jail?
Not if you answer our questions truthfully, replied Pine, trying to keep both her emotions and patience in check. Let's go back to the beginning for a minute. What happened after Ito dropped her off with you and then left? How did she end up with Joe and Desiree? Atkins scrunched up the Kleenex and laid it aside. She glanced once at her husband and then began.
The next morning, in the cold light of day, we were frantic. I mean, we believed what Ito had said, but there were still so many questions, and we didn't want to get into trouble, and we didn't know what to do with the child. She was scared and dirty and confused. We kept her for a few days and were wondering what the hell to do. Lynn found Ito's number and called him, but no one answered. He left messages, but Ito never called back. We were thinking about taking her to the police and telling them what Ito had done. I mean, we couldn't keep her. Then, when Joe and Desiree came by, we told them what had happened. Joe immediately said, We've always wanted kids. We'll adopt her and raise her. Well, that seemed like a good solution to me and Lynn.
Pine gave her an incredulous look. Mrs. Atkins, how could you possibly do that without checking to see whether Ito Vincenzo was really telling the truth? We're talking about a human being, not a puppy. A guy shows up in the middle of the night with a kid, and you just take her and that's it?
I know, said Atkins miserably. But Ito seemed very earnest, and he really seemed to care about the girl.
and we couldn't think of a reason why in the world he would have kidnapped a child and brought her to us. We trusted him.
Pine sighed heavily and sat back, scrutinizing the woman. Did you know that there was another little girl involved that night? Mercy's twin sister. Ito did a nursery rhyme, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, to choose which one to take. Then he struck the other little girl so hard he shattered her skull. She almost died. Atkinson's hand flew to her mouth, and fresh tears sprouted from her eyes.
Oh, dear God. Why would he do that? Why?
He did it for his brother, who was a mobster with a grudge against Mercy's family. He took Mercy and almost killed her sister to punish the parents.
Mobster? Ito?
No, Ito ran an ice cream parlor in Trenton. His brother was the mobster in the family. He shamed Ito into doing what he did. But it doesn't excuse Ito's crimes.
No. No, of course not. But we knew nothing about any of that.
So Joe wanted her, and you let Desiree take the girl, even though you knew Desiree was, as you said, evil?
Well, we didn't know that then. Back then, she was just sort of odd. I actually thought having a little girl to dote on and raise would be good for her, and I believed Joe would make a good father. They had been trying for kids and it hadn't worked, so this seemed like a blessing. And Desiree seemed eager to have her too. It was her idea to name her Rebecca.
But did you ever question Mercy about where she came from?
Well, yes, now that I recall.
And what did she say?
Well, she said that Ito had taken her from her parents because her parents wanted her dead, which matched up with what Ito had told us. It was all so horrible. Poor little child. Can you imagine parents saying that?
Mercy really told you that her parents wanted her dead, said Pine skeptically.
Well, come to think, I believe she said that's what Ito told her.
Pine shook her head at the woman's obliviousness. And in the days that followed, you never thought that this girl could be the same child who had been abducted in Andersonville, because it was all over the news by then.
Look, Lynn and me, we kept to ourselves. We didn't watch the news and we didn't go out much. If you've been to our old trailer, you know we didn't have any neighbors. I'd never heard the name Mercy till you mentioned it. I swear.
They heard moaning behind them and turned to see tears sliding down Len Atkins's cheeks. Atkins rose and stroked her husband's cheek.
It's okay, Len. I just have to tell them, okay?
He jerkily nodded, and she resumed her seat. Pine refocused on her. Did you know how Joe and Desiree were treating Mercy? Atkins stared down at the floor. She said slowly,
at first, things seemed normal. They seemed to be settling in as a family.
Did they formally adopt Mercy? Asked Blum.
They said they did.
But you never saw any paperwork? A certificate?
No.
Go on, said Pine.
Then it got to be that whenever we would come over to see her, they would scramble around and whisk the child away to dress her up and get her room clean. But I would talk to her and play with her, and things still seemed fine. Though, I could sense there was something strange going on.
How so? Atkins looked up, a pained expression on her face.
See, the thing was, Desiree never left us alone. She was always hovering. And Becky always wore long pants and long sleeves, even when it was hot and humid, like it is a lot in Georgia. And then, after 30 minutes or so, they'd swoop Becky, I mean Mercy, away. And that would be that.
And then at some point you found out the truth? Atkins nodded.
We made a surprise visit. Not to catch them doing anything, but just to stop by. I had found a cute dress from Mercy and wanted to give it to her. This was maybe 2 years after they got her. We heard screaming coming from the house. We both of us rushed in and...
Here, Atkin stopped for a moment and drew several long breaths, sucking on the oxygen coming into her nose like it was a line of crack.
What? Prompted Pine.
Another moan came from behind them. When Pine turned to look, Len Atkins was pantomiming something. He was pushing the fingers of his functioning arm into his damaged one. Pine whirled back on Atkins.
What is he trying to tell us? She demanded.
Mercy was tied down to a table, and Desiree was sticking needles into Mercy's arms and legs. Dozens and dozens of them. She was screaming in pain.
Chapter 16. Pine wiped the water off her face with the hand towel in the Atkins' bathroom. She looked at her reflection in the mirror over the sink. She almost didn't recognize the reflection staring back at her. She seemed transformed into something hollower than she had been before knocking on the Atkins' door, as though a core part of her had been ripped away. She drew a long breath and tried to settle her nerves. She had had to abruptly leave the room and come here after Wanda Atkins had told them about Mercy being tortured with needles. She went over to the window and looked out. A hawk was lazily flapping its wings as it made its way across the sky. She heard the sounds of children playing from another yard. A truck rumbled by. There was a car horn and the blustery noise of a motorcycle starting up somewhere. A white-haired woman was taking laundry off the backyard clothesline next door. All normal. All regular. And none of it had anything to do with how she was feeling, which was anything but normal. It was all ragged and piercing and traumatizing. And it's nothing compared to what Mercy endured. She shivered once, squared her shoulders firmly, though she in fact felt no spine in her body or soul, and returned to the front room to find both Atkins and Blum staring anxiously at her. Pine retook her seat after saying, "Sorry about that. I just had to take a moment. I've gotten personally involved in this case." She did not want to reveal to Atkins her familial connection to Mercy for a number of reasons. Atkins said slowly,
"Yes, well, I can understand that, sure."
She glanced apprehensively between Pine and Blum. Pine cleared her throat and said, "And did you think to take Mercy from her after you saw what Desiree was doing to her?"
"We were certainly stunned, but then Joe explained it away."
"How could he possibly do that?" said Pine between clenched teeth.
Atkins kneaded her thighs with her hands in agitation.
He said that Mercy had terrible pains, and that what Desiree was doing was sort of like that, oh, what do you call it when they stick the pins in you?"
"Acupuncture?" suggested Blum.
"Yes, that's right."
"Acupuncture doesn't make you scream in pain," pointed out Pine, her cold gaze square on the other woman. "The needles they use aren't anything like regular needles."
"Well, I believed my son,"
said Atkins defensively as she looked away.
"And did you know about them moving her from the house to the prison in the woods?"
Atkins winced at this.
They told us she was uncontrollable, that she would hurt herself and others. They had to take precautions. It was to keep her safe, too," she added.
Pine drew out the photo again.
"So this girl, standing right next to you, was uncontrollable and would hurt herself and others."
"Joe said they'd given her something to calm her down that day."
"Well, Joe seemed to have an answer for everything. Did you go out to the prison cell?"
Atkins looked up at her.
"I did."
"Why?"
She spread her arms and said in a near wail,
"Because I felt so sorry for her. I brought her food and books, and I talked to her about things, read to her, did numbers with her. I'm no teacher or anything, but I did what I could. I just wanted her to have a friend.
But you never told the authorities about what Desiree was doing to her? Interjected Blum. That she was being held prisoner.
Atkins shook her head.
I was afraid. Lynn and I could go to jail.
Pine said impatiently. Talk to me about that last night, when Joe was killed.
We had no idea any of that had happened. We only found out about Joe the next day.
If you lie to me, I will arrest you.
What do you mean?
Said Atkins, looking severely shaken. We know that Desiree vanished. We know she drove their truck to the location where it was found by the police. Her husband was dead, and Mercy was gone. Who would she call except you and your husband? You're the only ones who knew what was going on, who knew of their criminal acts. Pine stared the woman down.
So you need to tell us the truth.
Atkins eyed her husband, who had grunted at her, and then added a nod of his tilted head to that. Atkins turned back to Pine with a resigned expression.
She called while Lynn and me were watching TV. A rerun of Gilligan's Island. Funny how you remember things like that.
Go on, said Pine impatiently. Atkins said in a rush, her words coming out like beans spilled from a jar.
She said Becky had gone crazy, had broken out and killed Joe and then run off. Desiree said she had to get away or else they'd arrest her. She was out of her mind with panic.
Why would you agree to help her at that point? Asked Pine. With your son dead.
We were completely paralyzed by what she told us.
Tears slid down the old woman's cheeks.
My God, she had just told me my son had been murdered. And then that evil bitch threatened us. She said if we didn't help her, that she would tell the police we knew all about it. She said she'd tell the police that we had tortured Becky. Lynn and I didn't know what to do. We were scared out of our minds. Desiree can lie better than anybody, so we helped her get away.
How exactly did you do that?
We drove her all the way to Atlanta. She got a bus out.
To where?
I don't know. She wouldn't tell us. We haven't seen her since.
Or talked to her?
No, and good riddance.
And what did she tell you about Joe's death?
She said that Joe tried to stop Becky, I mean Mercy, from leaving. And they fought.
And Mercy killed him, said Pine.
That's what Desiree said.
And you believed her?
I didn't know what to believe. It was all a blur by then.
And the sheriff told you about Joe the next day? Atkins's eyes filled with fresh tears.
I already knew he was dead, but I had to pretend to be shocked. It was the worst day of my whole life.
And what did the sheriff tell you about Joe?
He was sure that Desiree had killed him. I mean, he had no idea about Mercy living there. We told him we hadn't seen or heard from Desiree.
So you lied to him and obstructed the investigation, said Pine bluntly. Atkins nodded, her features full of misery.
I suppose we did, yes.
Pine eyed Lynn Atkins, who looked back at her mournfully. He slowly shook his head. I think your husband would like you to tell the truth. Atkins glanced sharply at him.
I am telling the truth,
Pine said firmly. So your son's body lay outside all night long and was untouched by animals, not one bite taken out of him, according to the police. Atkins put a trembling hand to her face.
Please stop, please.
Len grunted. Pine glanced at him once more. He was staring fiercely at his wife. Atkins looked at him, drew in a sharp breath, and said,
Okay, we went over there and saw Joe's body. We had to. He was our son. We had to make sure. We didn't know if Desiree was lying or what. When we saw he was dead, we couldn't leave our son out there alone.
She teared up again.
It was horrible. Lynn had his shotgun, and he kept watch and scared the critters away, but the flies, they were all over him.
She let out a gush of air and took some time to calm while Pine and Blum waited. Atkins wiped her eyes with her sleeve and said,
I met Desiree at the old Esso station and drove her to Atlanta while Lynn guarded Joe's body. The next morning, he was going to call 911 from a payphone and tell them about Joe without identifying who he was.
Why wait until the next morning? Interjected Pine.
Desiree wanted time to get away. But then early the next morning, before I got back from taking Desiree, Lynn heard someone coming and hid. A man was walking his dog. He found Joe's body and ran off, obviously to call the police. I got there about 10 minutes later and Lynn told me what had happened. We drove back together to the trailer. When the police showed up later, we acted all surprised.
Pine studied her. Did you look at the body closely?
It was our son, if that's what you're asking.
Blum interjected.
We know this is hard, Wanda, but we're trying to find Mercy. Anything you can tell us about what you observed that night will help.
Atkins wiped her eyes and said firmly,
There was a knife sticking in my son's back, and he was dead. That's what I saw.
Anything else? Asked Pine.
I don't know. I was so upset.
She paused.
He had a lump and some blood on his head. I remember that.
Did you see signs of a struggle? Asked Pine.
No, but I'm not sure what I would be looking for.
What did Desiree say actually happened, as detailed as you can recall?
That Mercy got away somehow, and Joe tried to stop her, and she attacked him, and stabbed him, and then ran off.
Where'd she get the knife?
Desiree didn't say.
There was a gunshot, said Pine. On the surveillance tape, we heard a shot.
I don't know anything about that. Desiree never mentioned a gunshot.
Did Desiree have a shotgun when you saw her at the Esso station?
No.
Did she tell you where she was going? Are you sure you haven't been in contact with her over the years? Not once?
No. I don't want to ever see that awful woman again, Atkins snapped.
And then you moved away?
Yes. We sold Joe's house. With Desiree gone, we were next of kin. We used that money to buy this place. Joe also had money in some bank accounts from his business. All of that came to us, too, she added, shooting them nervous glances.
I see. Pine rose, took out a couple of her business cards, and handed them to Atkins. You think of anything else, or if you hear from Desiree, please call me.
I doubt we'll hear from her after all this time.
Oh, you just never know, do you? Chapter 17. As they drove away from the house, Pine said, She was lying.
How so? Asked Blum.
Desiree would never walk away and leave them all that money from the house sale and the bank accounts. If she was going to start over, she needed financial resources. I'm betting Wanda knows where she is, and they keep in contact just in case someone like us shows up asking questions. And I think the shotgun Joe had was the same one that Len used to guard his son that night.
If you're right, what are we going to do about it?
Pine glanced in the rearview mirror. If they are in contact with her, our visit must have really shaken up old Wanda. In fact, Pine suddenly pulled off the road, put the Porsche in park, and said, I'll be back in a minute. She climbed out and hustled back down the street. Before she reached the Atkinses' home, she cut through a stand of woods and came up on the rear of the property. She jumped over the chain-link fence and headed up to the back of the house. There was an open screened window that looked directly into the kitchen. As she peered through it, Pine had to suddenly duck down. Wanda walked into the kitchen, looking pale and distraught. There was a phone hanging on the wall directly across from Pine.